Mentioned in Dispatches, we are in season 7, episode 5, 6, 4, something like that. This is the Origins episode, right? We're not going to bother numbering things. As we are recording this, Origins isn't even a week gone by at this point. And so we decided to bring in some of the great folks that made Origins such a fun time. And so to that end, we have Gary. Art Wolf himself has joined us. Gary, how are you?
I'm pretty good.
This is like, what, 3 or 4 straight nights of war game broadcasting and recording for you, right?
I didn't. Or playing, yeah. So
yeah, okay.
The show on Monday, and we had our live game on Tuesday where we wrapped up the Compass Games at NATO and started setting up the next thing, and then here we are tonight, and this is my second recording of the night.
Yeah, so you're like averaging more than one a day at this point, which is kind of nuts.
Yeah, my speaking voice is sounding awesome, though. It's nice and gravelly. I'm going to sound like Walter Matthau.
Yeah, you're going to be auditioning for a Norwegian metal band next, right?
Soon.
Awesome. Love it. And then a first-time guest for here on Mentioned in Dispatches, and we didn't even bring him on to talk about his own games. We brought him on to talk about Origins. Kevin from Fort Circle Games is joining us. Kevin, how are you?
I'm doing great, and see, I'm wise enough to not to be overexposed like Gary, so who's the media genius here after all?
Oh, I'm definitely overexposed.
Hey, hang on. At least one of us is not wearing pants, right?
At least one.
Possibly none of us are wearing pants.
Gary has the kilt going tonight.
Not tonight. Yeah. I actually thought about wearing it to Origins on Saturday.
You wouldn't have been the only one.
Oh, absolutely not.
Yeah. So speaking of Origins, let's dive right into this. Gary, I know you were there for most of it with us, hanging out in the Wargame HQ with the Dragoons, and we appreciate you stepping up and helping us fill the gap for lack of GMs this year. What was the coolest thing you saw at Origins overall, whether it was a game, whether it was a costume, whether it was people, whether it was something in the exhibit hall? What's the coolest thing you saw at Origins this year?
I didn't really get to look around nearly as much as I typically do because, you know, not that I was tied down the whole time. That's not really true, but I wasn't quite feeling the love of all the walking, and I did do a lot of walking through that dealer's room. Coolest thing I saw was probably the licensed Dyson Logos shower curtains, Dungeon Map shower curtains and throw blankets, which were all in the $20, $25, $30 range.
And you threatened to bring the shower curtain home at one point.
I did, and that I have not been murdered is a sign that I did not actually bring that home to my wife.
Yeah, I was on one of my treks around the exhibit hall. I was sending pictures of different stuff home to my wife. Hey, check this out. Hey, get a laugh at this. Hey, what do you think of this? And the shower curtain was kind of immediately nixed, but the throw blanket at least got a moment's consideration.
Mm-hmm.
And for folks wondering, those pictures are down below on this podcast episode. You can go take a look for yourself and see the throw blanket and shower curtain with the dungeon map motif on them.
I took probably 10% of the number of pictures I normally take.
Oh, ditto.
Yeah, just because I didn't do all that walking around, checking out every corner of the convention, taking pictures of absolutely everything.
I did not take near as many as normal. The flip side of that, again, with us being on a short crew out of the Dragoons booth, we have a pair of folks that are our journalists at Origins, that they are there just to be the – I mean, they're shepherding their kids around as a part of it. But we have a couple of families that work our corner of the universe there that – we got some of the guys are part of the event team, and some of the wives have offered to be our journalists over the years. And so typically out of one of them, I get anywhere from 700 to 900 pictures over the weekend. And we obviously sift through some of those before we start posting them on the site. I'm not sure I hit a full 100 myself this year. So we are definitely short on photos compared to normal.
Yeah, I could tell you I didn't. I normally do probably 200 to 300 photos. I did probably 40. This year.
Yeah. Kevin, what was the coolest? Wait, before we get into that, this was your first Origins, wasn't it?
Yes. So I've been to the Gamma Trade show probably 10 times, reaching back into the 90s, but I've never really been a fan of big conventions. But now that I publish games, I have to go. And so I was lucky that Jason Matthews and I drove out from DC, and he was a great kind of guide to the whole event. So I actually had a great time, and I'm looking forward to going next year. In fact, might volunteer to GM with you folks, because I thought it was a great atmosphere. I really enjoyed it. So interestingly enough, the things that I liked the best weren't games that I played. Like, I really liked the look of Sebastian Bay's game that you guys had set up. I'm not sure if you ended up playing it or not. Some folks had a game that looked like kind of a Axis and Allies type game on the Mediterranean World War II, but like they had nice wood pieces for the ships and such. And so like there were a lot of neat games I saw that I didn't get to end up play, but that, you know, I'm really excited about. So it was a totally successful event for me. I'm really happy that I went. So it was a great time.
That war and the med thing did look really neat.
Yeah, and I chatted with them briefly, just like for, you know, maybe 5 minutes. So I didn't even really get a rules explanation or anything, but I liked the look of it. And the one of the designers there also did the graphic design work for the map, and I thought that map looked fantastic. It's one of the better maps I've seen for anything in the Mediterranean. So
the map was definitely nice. Yeah, it was the game was called Song for War Mediterranean Theater. And just a brief chat with the designer, it seems as though if this one is a success, they want to expand Song for War to other theaters as well. But it's interesting they chose the Med as the first one to do, but I think it's kind of neat because you tend to get a lot of things around the Med in World War II, where it's either North Africa or Sicily or Italy, but you don't normally get the Med as your thing. And so that was kind of a neat approach they took. You're right. The map did look really nice. So,
well, yeah, you know, I'm fond of really sweet too.
Yeah, and I'm fond of games set in the Mediterranean. So, you know, it was a natural draw for me.
Yeah, who would have seen that coming? For the four people in our audience that don't know, Kevin is the designer behind Shores of Tripoli, which was the first publication from Fort Circle, and it won Game of the Year. What was the magazine that awarded it Game of the Year, Kevin?
New York Magazine. So.
New York Magazine. So yeah. Not somebody from the Wargaming Press recognized it as their Game of the Year last year, I think.
Yeah, best two-player game, not best game overall, but still, okay. You know, well, I'll take whatever game I can get, so I appreciate that. So and, I can think of actually a couple games that might have been better last year, but, you know, it was nice for the mention.
Yeah, so when Kevin's talking about games set in the Med, he has one. I'll tell you, one of the cooler things that I saw was I thought it was really awesome that Catastrophe Games was there, that we had a new war game publisher putting themselves out there, jumping into the pool, you know, feet first into the deep end, and Tim was there with his new company. He did have a whole lot of other folks' stuff in his booth, and that's because Catastrophe Games, like a couple of the other print-on-demand publishers, uses Blue Panther as their print shop. And so Steve, the guy that runs Blue Panther, was there working the booth with Tim. And so they had a rack of other stuff Steve prints as well. So they had stuff from Hollenspiel, from White Dog, from CSL. Those were the other three companies that I saw. They might have had some others. Those are just the three I saw. A lot of Hollenspiel, some of the others. But Tim was there showing off his new stuff. He's got a couple of games already in print. He's got a Kickstarter that's live as we're recording this, but I think it's going to wrap up before this podcast goes live. On tactical warfare in the counterinsurgency in Afghanistan, and Tim lived it for a little while. He was deployed downrange at one point. And so it was really cool to see a new war game publisher take that plunge and stick themselves out there and, you know, keep flying that flag for wargaming at Origins. I thought that was great. And so as much as anything else, I want to make sure that they get recognized as one of the awesome things I saw in Oregon.
And Tim was a really nice guy. You know, I had helped him out a tiny bit when he was kind of getting off and running, like, you know, what were best practices around Kickstarter. You know, you email with people, but when you meet them, it's nice, you know, to put that face to a name. And he seems like a great guy. I think that company is going to do great things going forward. So I'm really happy he's taking swings. So.
Yeah, the mask part threw me off a little bit, though. We'll get to the mask in a second. But Tim with his mask on, I didn't recognize him for, like, the first three conversations I had with him. Tim has actually been at Origins before just as an attendee and has sat down and played a bunch of stuff with us in the wargaming area over the years. Obviously not 2020 because nobody did. But going back to 2018, 2017, Tim was there as a player and jumped in a couple of our events. And it took a second having that conversation for the kind of everything to connect for me that, oh, yeah, that's who this dude is. So it was cool to see a dude who's been a player before join the community as a publisher and get his stuff out there. That's great. Kevin, I know you had Jason with you on your travels. I know Jason sat down and played Tim's game at one point. Were you there when they were going through that?
No, I wasn't. I missed I missed out on that. But did you hear how it went? Or
So just a brief conversation with Jason, plus seeing what he posted on social media, that he was very complimentary of Tim's design and jumped into the Kickstarter. I did not. The two times that I had time to go over to Tim's booth to go try and check out the game for myself, he had actual customers lined up at the booth, and so I wasn't going to get in the way of people wanting to give him money. So
yeah,
I
just that makes sense. So.
Waved, said, "Hey, keep selling your stuff," and got out of the way. And that turned out to be a theme for me with a couple of booths this year, that every time I went by to say hi and go check something out, they had other people there trying to give them money, and so I just got out of the way.
I was actually happy to meet Steve, too, because we use Blue Panther to print our playtest kits. So for both Halls of Montezuma and Votes for Women, we printed 100 playtest kits. And, you know, we have to ship him the cards and ship him the pieces. And then he prints the map and the rules and puts it in the box. And I'll be honest, I'm really happy, like, for the components. They're really, you know, it's a good for our playtest kits. But, you know, obviously people can use them to print real games, too. And, you know, I really think that's a great service. I'm a big fan of Blue Panther.
Yeah, I have a handful of their stuff on the shelf here. I've got the White Tribe from White Dog Games that I did an extended, like, 7-part series of articles on the site. You know, those components are really nice. They're compared to some things you get from, like, Fantasy Flight, yes, it does look like it came off a smaller printing press instead of those big 50,000-unit monstrosities that Gary and I have talked about with the global shipping crisis before. But I'll tell you that the stuff Blue Panther prints stands up easily against anything printed before about 2008, as you can't tell the difference in quality one bit. It is really nice stuff. The counters are thick, they're solid, things aren't falling apart. They look really nice. Especially a couple of things from White Dog and Hollenspiel are just gorgeous productions. Even the rule books look nice. And yeah, I've been really impressed with it.
Yeah, we had them print some campaign buttons for Votes for Women, and they were printed on chipboard that was really thick. And I've actually had playtesters saying they're worried that what comes out of China isn't going to be as high of a quality as what Steve printed for our playtest kits. So that's a pretty good endorsement.
That's interesting to hear. That's kind of cool to hear. So that's neat. Gary, did you get a chance to check out Zermatt at all?
I did not, no.
Okay. I didn't think so, just based on what you'd been saying about the limited time to wander around there. But
yeah, I mean, I saw it. They were demoing it at their small booth, which, you know, was in, I had to, like, look in the book to find where their booth was, because it was in, like, that very back section, which is a lot of times it's all, like, artists and cosplay booths and stuff like that, which is, you know, not the space I spend tons of time in. No. But they were kind of, you know, tucked away in the back corner. But there were people there, like, every time I went over there.
Yeah.
And they were demoing Zermatt every time I went over there.
Since Gary brought it up, just a quick mention on some of the organization and layout of the exhibit hall. Normally, Origins have one full giant hall of the Columbus Convention Center just for the exhibitors. And then around that, they have the gaming halls arranged. The last few years, they've had the exhibit hall in the middle with game halls on either side of it. So you get a lot more traffic flow between the game halls and the side entrances to the exhibit hall, which, Gary, you've been going to Origins a long time. Mm-hmm. I've been doing this, you know, 16, 17 years now. I thought the traffic flow those couple of years when they did that worked really, really well.
Sure.
This year, instead of multiple halls, the first day, everything was in one hall. The back half was the exhibit hall. The front half was the gaming area. And look, let's face it, this is a pandemic year still. We've got a smaller crowd there. There were going to be limitations on what they could have. I think they made the most of the space they had available for those days. When they opened up the side door to expand the gaming space into the other hall, it looked like they didn't completely fill the hall next to us.
Not immediately. No, it was about half that hall.
It was about half.
Yeah,
and
that's true. It was pretty much, I mean, there's three big halls in that convention center, right? Which Origins normally eats all of. In this case, starting on Friday, it ate 1.5. So it was, in terms of footprint over there, it was exactly half the space. Yes. And then there is stuff that took place outside that big room, right? There was the bays across the hall from the big exhibit halls that they had some things going on up there. We had the RPG stuff over at the Hyatt still, which took up probably about a third as much space as it typically does.
Yeah, for the exhibit hall area, the like you said, the convention halls, it was half the space it normally fills. Things outside the convention halls, it was significantly smaller. You said about a third of the RPG stuff. I know for Origins University, Origins War College, a lot of the seminar tracks, film festival kinds of things, those took up maybe 25% at most of the normal space that they occupy. The you mentioned the bays across the primary walkway, across the entrances to the exhibit halls. This year, it looked like they only had two of them filled, one with Steve Jackson and one with the authors area, where normally there's four or five of those things pretty full with a bunch of different folks. But within the arrangement of the exhibit hall itself, just the kind of the market bazaar area, if you will, it was smaller than normal. We knew that was going to happen. One of the other things that they did back there, so Gary, you mentioned the back half of the exhibit hall where the artists and cosplay kind of stuff is. The way they had laid the exhibit hall out this year, they had the artists in kind of the back right corner of that, which they normally have the artists towards the rear of the room anyway. And then the back left was primarily the entrepreneurial booths, which is what Catastrophe Games fell into. And so typically those are booths that are done at a slightly discounted rate in order to give new companies a chance to be at the show. And I think that's what Catastrophe Games fell into. Back in 2005, when I was there as Bayonet Games, that was what we fell into. The first time we were there, we were in an entrepreneurial booth. And so we paid probably about two-thirds the regular booth rate in order to be in there as a brand new company, first time there, et cetera, et cetera. And
did
so I
you
think
happen
that's
to,
why you had them in the back of the building.
Did you happen to see what the prices were for booths this year? Did they publish them?
I did not. I did not. I know normally they run for a single 10 by 10 booth, not a corner end cap or any special placement. Just give me a 10 by 10 space in there somewhere. They normally run just over $1,000, but I don't know what might have happened this year given the plague conditions and everything else.
Yeah, that is information that I think you can normally find on the website for the upcoming year, which, you know, yes. their timetable on updating that website is always really, really late. But
and so, it's going to feel later this year, given that we're already on a compressed timeline to next summer's Origin.
Yes.
So, but yeah, Gary is exactly right. They don't tend to update that site in the most expeditious manner. So the entrepreneurial area, Gary, that you're where Catastrophe was found, you're right. There's often a lot of oddballs and one-offs and weirdities back there, as opposed to a more unified feel of, hey, here's a bunch of war game stuff. The war game vendors were absolutely spread out this year. They were in a couple of different places. The other thing that was different this year, in the middle of, towards the back middle of one of the aisles, they had a whole bunch of video game related organizations, not video game vendors, but think tanks, some development shops, a couple of university organizations. And what that was, Origins this year had combined with GDEX, which is a Columbus-based digital gaming conclave. I'm not really sure the best way to describe it. That normally has a small event similar to Origins, and they don't normally do it over the summer like Origins does. They normally do it later in the fall. So I think this was Gamma doing two things, quite frankly. One, trying to find a way to get some cross-pollination going, get some tabletop guys in front of the digital folks and vice versa, but to be able to expose those digital folks to some of the tabletop industry to potentially make some business connections there. And the more cynical view is probably also not wrong. They needed to fill some space in that exhibit hall, and bringing the GDEX guys in helped do that. And so I don't think we can discount that as a motivation either.
There is typically a minimal video game presence in the exhibit hall at Origins.
And it kind of capped out in 2007, 8, 9 time frame, back when David Heath was running Matrix Games, and they would have a big 3 or 4 booth wide space up against one wall with a whole lot of their digital war games there. And we're constantly showing those off. They did pretty good at Origins those couple years they were there, but there hasn't been a real significant digital gaming presence, Gary, you're right, since then. It's been pretty minimal. The GDEX thing I don't think was a bad addition to it. I didn't talk to very many of those guys. every time I walked by there, most of them looked pretty bored in their boots. I'm just not sure how many of the tabletop gamers looking to spend money at the exhibit hall were stopping to talk to the guys from Indiana University who were there for, you know, talking about their game development program. I
have no numbers or official information of any kind, which to my knowledge has not been announced at this point. My gut instinct is to say that I do not feel that a large percentage of the exhibit hall traffic was GDEX traffic.
Oh, guaranteed not. So, no, absolutely not. So I would definitely agree with that. So.
Now, the other thing is that exhibit hall, despite, and I suspect you may have been going in this direction, that exhibit hall, you know, which was around half of the size that it usually is. I'm talking the vendor area, right?
Yes.
Seemed pretty much as crowded or more crowded as it does in every other year, right?
Yeah, totally. I did not. So aside from not having as much real estate to stomp around, I did not feel that Origins didn't really feel smaller once you were in the exhibit hall and you were moving around through the crowd.
Yeah.
Obviously, there was less space to move around in that, you know, it was half of what you normally have for an exhibit hall.
Well, I don't know if anybody else noticed this, but the aisles, especially toward the front of the exhibitor area, the aisles were like quite a bit tighter than they typically are.
Yes. And honestly, they felt as busy. You still had to dodge just as many people carrying around mini fridges disguised as board game backpacks that were knocking you in the head whenever they turned.
Yeah. Some knucklehead wrapped somebody in the coconut with a camera.
Great. I'm not surprised. And probably kept filming.
Oh, I totally did.
So
I didn't actually hit anybody with the camera. I did step on somebody's feet, though.
Of the war game vendors that were there, or folks selling war games, but the primary war game companies, look, Decision was there. They're always there. They're always supportive of Origins. They always drag everything out here from California. Decision had a pretty big booth and seemed to be moving stuff through it. Gary, I know you spent some money there.
What
was your impression of how Decision's traffic seemed whenever you were going by there?
There were people. I was not the only person that spent money there. I can tell you that I was not the only person pawing through the games. I don't know that they really brought less product. They had a booth that was smaller, but I don't know that they had less stuff. And in fact, in like a lot of the non-Decision stuff that Decision sells at Origins, like the stuff from Revolution Games and Legion War Games and doing the simulations and all, I feel like they had more of that than they typically do. So it was not, they did not have like a reduced presence in terms of square footage. I think it was smaller, but in every other respect, it was completely typical.
They still crammed a lot into it. I think one of the things for a lot of years, Decision was also there repping one of the Eurogame companies. And I want to say Rio Grande, but I'm probably wrong and somebody will correct us in the forums.
You are right about that. And I don't remember who that was because they are, whoever they are, they produce many fine games that I am not interested in at all.
But Decision Games booth footprint used to be a little bigger because they had some table space behind their primary display in order to show off some of those Euro games.
Yes.
And that obviously they dispensed with that this year. That was not there at all. So we talked about Catastrophe Games. They were a 10x10 booth. I've been in a 10x10 booth. There ain't a lot of room in a 10x10 booth for anything, I promise you. It was pretty well packed, but they did have room for the table where they were demoing Zermatt. You just couldn't really demo more than maybe two people at a time at the most, just because of floor space. And that's cool. That's fine. Academy Games was there. Gary, I don't know if you took note of when they arrived the day before the show started.
We joked about it. I didn't actually take note, but
they were one of the last ones there. Which shocks nobody. But yeah, they were one of the last ones there. We did have Enterprise Games, our good buddies that support a lot of what we do at the Wargame HQ. They had their usual end cap booth and stock full of GMT stuff because they are the primary GMT rep at Origins.
Yep. Pretty much everything that GMT has in stock plus more, they brought with them. So if you needed GMT stuff and GMT has it, Enterprise, including the counter trays. I was actually surprised because of the time frame. GMT literally just got counter trays in like in the last couple of weeks. So I didn't expect them to have them, but they did. They sold out, by the way.
Yeah, that's probably Thursday afternoon they were sold out of those guys.
I think it was Friday, actually. But, it was Friday because the people that bought the last counter trace then came over and played in my Commands and Colors game.
All right. And then
it was, well, I just wanted to say it's nice. Yeah. It was nice to see them there, but I really wish GMT would recommit to coming to Origins, because, you know, they are the tent, right, for the industry. They're our big name for, you know, in a very small pond, they are the big fish. And it would be nice if they started coming to Origins again. I don't know when it was they stopped coming, but, you know, they're the flagship. It'd be nice to see them there, you know, maybe not this year because it's a weird year, but hopefully next year or soon they'll start coming back. So that would be nice.
Has GMT always been based in California? I have assumed that they have been, but I don't know.
As far as I know, yes. But I know that when they were coming to Origins in 05, 06, 07, 08 timeframe, when I was still a vendor and they were right down the aisle from me, that they were based in California at the time.
Okay.
So they may have moved to California from somewhere else. I don't think so. I think they've always been in California. But if not, at least for a significant chunk of the time, they were still coming to Origins. Kevin, you're right. It would be really cool. I want to hold that thought, and let's come back around to it a little later in the show, because they're not the only company that applies to, and I want to talk in a little more depth around that once we finish sort of circling around.
Sure, absolutely.
Who was there at the exhibit hall? So it's a great point. I want to hold.
Yeah, we'll table it for now. That's fine.
Yeah. Kevin, you may have gone through the Enterprise booth in a little greater detail. Gary, I'm sure you did. My primary contribution to Enterprise booth was helping Don unload the van and wheeling all that stuff into the building for them. but it's
their booth is in many ways undistinguishable from my home office.
Yeah, well, there's that. How much non-GMT stuff did you see at Enterprise's booth?
So they had the two big tables in front, and then they had a side table on each side. And all that was all GMT stuff. Some of it was the stuff from like Vevictus and Hexasim that GMT also sells domestically. And then they had a stand-up shelf that was all GMT stuff on the right side. And then they had a stand-up shelf that was about half other non-GMT stuff on the left side. Of the non-GMT stuff, they had stuff from Hexasim. But again, you know, that's, you know, GMT is where to get that stuff in the U.S. They had some stuff from Compass. They had some stuff from MMP, but it was all older stuff. Well, it wasn't all that old. Some of it was older stuff. They had some stuff from some offshore publishers, that Kiko Nero Publications, from Chinese publisher that I bought Dragon and the Cross from. It was a mix of odds and ends.
And yeah. Two Ticket to Ride.
And they had Ticket to Ride over there for some reason.
So Enterprise Games is GMT's official rep in the exhibit hall, and there's supposed to be an exclusivity agreement where they are the only ones carrying GMT stuff in the exhibit hall. GMT's apparently worked that out with Gamma over the years. As far as I know, that's still in place. Again, if I'm wrong, somebody will send me an email and yell at me, and that's fine. Enterprise Games isn't just a GMT outlet. They are an actual game retailer and carry a ton of stuff from a lot of people. One of the other things Enterprise Games will do for you for Origins, and I know some people that have taken advantage of this, if you place an order with Don ahead of time, especially used or out of print things that they wouldn't normally bring with them, they'll bring it to you at the show and you can pick it up from them there. Because I've seen people done that. I've actually done that for my cousin. My cousin placed an order with Don and I brought it home from Origins with All right, so in the exhibit hall, we talk Catastrophe, Academy, Enterprise, Decision. Ares Games was there with a couple of their war game stuff, but that wasn't the main stuff they were showing off. I did see March on the Drina for sale in someone else's booth, so there were some people carrying war game-ish things. And I saw a bunch of minis war game rules, like the Black Powder rules for American Civil War stuff. Saw those in a couple of places. Kevin, I'm curious, how much did you actually spend at Origins? Are you willing to admit to any of it?
Well, my wife's here right by me, so I spent nothing because I just went for the experience. No, actually, I did not buy anything. That's actually the true story. There were a bunch of things I was going to buy, but then I'm just like, you know, I just dropped the ball on Saturday and didn't pick anything up. The Sun and the Cross game was something I meant to pick up. There were a number of games that I was going to pick up and then I just didn't. So that's the story I'm sticking to.
That's what you're sticking to, huh?
Yeah.
So Gary, you threatened to not answer this.
I spent $0 at Cool Stuff.
You and many others. So here's the question. Were you over or under 55,000 yen?
I have no idea how much. I was definitely under $55,000.
I think you were close, though, at one point.
So, I mean, I've shown off the loot picture, which, and there'll be a loot video, which undoubtedly will be, already be out by the time this is broadcast. So it's not like it's going to be a big secret on what I bought. Everything that I bought other than a small handful of dice from Black Oak Workshop is in that video.
Yeah, I have learned that the key thing to keeping your expenditures down at Origins
is don't go.
Is to attend either when you're unemployed or in that weird space between being a contractor and being a full-timer when the paychecks haven't quite kicked in yet. Because then you're torn between gas money versus buying cool new things and you don't feel like pushing your car home through West Virginia. So at that point, it keeps your expenditures down some. I managed to get out of there right around or just barely over $100 for the weekend, which is astounding. Gary's seen some of the stacks of stuff I've taken out of there in years past. That is kind of astounding for me.
So I actually wasn't kidding when I spent zero, but I realized like every GMT game, I P500 if I want it. I own all of Catastrophe's games or have backed them on Kickstarter. And so there's like very few things that I don't actually have that I go see at a convention. And because, you know, I'm already traveling with clothes and it's a long drive. I just didn't even think to buy things at the convention. Although there are, like I say, one or two things I wish I had bought. So
I'll mention this just so it doesn't get missed. Another person that had a significant number of war games for sale was Colonel Lou Zaki, who was there and who had his traditional booth with the dice in the front and a rack, couple of racks of miscellaneous old things behind him. This year he had a copy of Their Finest Hour, the old Europa series title on the Battle of Britain, and I was like texting back and forth on whether it was a good price. It was $85 on whether it was a good price or not. It's like it's unpunched, the box is a bit scuffed, and by the time I got back over there it was gone. So it turned out that some nice fella saved me $85.
Someone who thought it was an acceptable price without having him and haul over it.
Having done the research now that I've like looked and seen what it's going for, it is actually a pretty good price on punt.
Yeah. Lou was there. I was surprised to see Lou there. For the folks that don't know, he collapsed at Gen Con during setup day and ended up spending Gen Con in a hospital bed while his daughter and a couple of stray gamers who pitched in to help out ran the booth, which I think is a fantastic testament to the gamer community. But that's what happened at Gen Con. And so, look, it was only like a 3-week gap from Gen Con to Origins. Maybe it was only 2 weeks. I was stunned to see Lou there at all. He was in a wheelchair every time I saw him, but dude was there.
It wasn't a wheelchair. It was one of those walker chair type of things.
Is that what it was?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know what those are called.
Someone asked, you know, has Lou ever missed an Origins or a Gen Con? And
yeah, he has actually, but you know, it's this is what Lou loves doing. So
yes,
you know, I'm not going to tell him he's got to stay home.
Yeah, if he misses one, there was some extreme circumstance to it. I will say that somebody else chimed in and said, "I'm pretty sure Lou is older than dice, so probably no." But so I will say, at least my own experiences in the exhibit halls, and Gary, you tend to go out of there with a whole lot of war games because you're often hunting some rarities in cases when you're hitting some of those war game booths. Given the nature of what we do here at Armchair Dragoons and some of the other folks I'm connected with, and then also, look, we've admitted it before, I'm spoiled. I have Gamer's Armory here in my backyard. I tend to not leave Origins with a ton of war games that I've bought. I tend to leave with other stuff that I don't normally find around here. And so I've got a game that we picked up that's a Christmas present for my daughter that we're holding on to until December. I've got a whole bunch of dice. You mentioned the dice before. I think I bought dice from like four different places just because they're dice, right? You just can't help yourself.
Yeah. And let me mention that there's like 15 different dice booths now, right?
Yeah.
There used to be two.
And Chessex wasn't there.
Yeah. Well, Chessex hasn't been in several years. And I actually like Chessex dice, but yeah, there's tons of dice. Now, some of which are like the super expensive dice made of rare South American woods and carved by, you know, gnomes and stuff like that and cost $150 a die. But not all of them. There's plenty of affordable dice there, too.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
well, there's been a real cottage industry that's grown up around Dice on Kickstarter, like
and Etsy.
Dice on there all the time. Yeah, or Etsy, and you know, sometimes that's mm-hmm. a lot of the same people that there's a real appetite for dice. I mean, like,
yeah, nice just dice. Actually, just today I got a set of cast resin dice that Ooh. Showed it's not Origins related, but that were people in Pittsburgh are casting these themselves. The masters are 3D printed and then they make silicone molds and cast them in resin. And they're really gorgeous. I'm thrilled with them.
That's pretty cool.
And they weren't, I mean, they weren't cheap, but they weren't that expensive.
Yeah. Yeah. So the dice booths that I saw this year, Black Oak was there. Crystal Cast was there. Easy Roller Dice Company was there. Metallic Dice Games were there. Those were the four that I saw that were primarily dice vendors. Now there were at least three other ones. Well, there were other folks that sold dice alongside other stuff. Like the Wormwood dude sell dice, like carved from Italian marble or whatever the hell.
Yeah.
Everything at that Wormwood booth
becomes by the dice. Ghost of Caesar.
I swear the Wormwood booth, I get why they come to game conventions. I'm not sure that your typical game convention attendee can even afford to stop and look at the Wormwood booth.
Well, the good news is if they sell one dice tower, their booth's paid for.
Yes, there is that. There were other vendors selling dice, but I didn't see them as sort of a primary thing. Part of that depends on how you count Lou, right? Is Game Science primarily a dice vendor, or are they sort of Lou's attic?
I think they're primarily a Lou vendor, actually. You know what I'm saying? I think they're there because Lou wants to be.
And God bless him. Like, yeah. You know, we're running out of the elder statesmen of the industry, so it's great that he's there.
Yeah.
As Armchair Dragoons continue the seventh season of Mentioned in Dispatches, we need to take a moment to thank those Patreon supporters who pledged at the regimental patron level. So a special thank you to Patrick Mullen, Hethwill Wargames, Steelgrave, Mike Quigley, Staggerwing, Robert, Joseph Knoll, Treb Curry, Kevin Bertram, and Patrick Garrity for their support of Armchair Dragoons and helping us bring you the best wargaming content on the web. You can join our Patreon supporters at patreon.com/armchairdragoons.
The fellow who just passed away, actually, I was going to mention was an RPG notable. Terry Amthor, co-designer of Rollmaster, passed away in the last week or so.
He's also the guy that for long after Rollmaster was done as a legit game system, kept the Shadow World going, of which he was a co-designer.
He's the originator of Shadow World.
Yeah. Okay.
That's a little complicated because of the heritage of the early products, which got sort of retrofitted in. But up to like the last couple of years, he was producing, you know, PDF stuff through DriveThruRPG. Exactly.
Yeah. Shadow World way outlasted Rollmaster, and he was the guiding hand of it all those years.
Do not speak such filth to me.
Kevin, did any of the dice booths catch your eye? Was there anything in any of the dice merchants or did you just sort of blow right past them? Toys to play with.
Yeah, I like dice are pretty utilitarian for me. I'm not really ooh and ah about all the fancy stuff. So
I think that's probably true for a lot of wargamers, actually. That they're not into the super fancy dice. They might like say, hey, I want red and green dice for this game. And I'm kind of like that too, for the most part. But I do RPGs too, and I kind of like nice dice, but I also, you know, don't spend tons and tons of money on dice.
I would say the one conceit I have is that I hate four-sided dice so much. So I like picking up alternate dice for four-sided dice, usually 12-siders that, you know, are 1-1-1, 2-2-2, 3-3-3, 4-4-4. Mm-hmm. But other than that, I'm just like, I'll just roll whatever. In fact, I like smaller dice too. I have a D12
that you would love because they're not just numbered 1-4. They are the cast, the coloration is like a granite color. And the 1-4 that are repeated on there are in Roman numerals. It's great.
Oh, I have some of those, actually.
Yeah, I have some of those. I don't like them because, really? You know, I like seeing numbers. I bought some of those through Chessex, actually. And I was like, these are okay, but I like just traditional American numbers, not American, Arabic numbers, so as opposed to Roman.
I probably fall more in Gary's camp of I'm also an RPG-er, in parallel with being a wargamer. So I'm all about the interesting, neat, weird, cool, fun dice and have no problem picking up a bunch. I do want to note on the podcast, Gary and I, you Gary, you and I talked about this at the show. Kevin, you might have heard some of the story. So we've talked about this before. Everybody's got crap stuck on a boat somewhere, right? And probably half the Kickstarters on the planet are currently anchored off of Long Beach or drifting aimlessly off of Long Beach.
Or docked in Canada because they got rerouted to Vancouver. Somebody's boat ended up going through Canada.
I think that was Free League's T2K stuff.
I think so, yeah. So that's worth a mention is that, you know, folks go out of their way in the wargaming hobby to point out that there's a lot fewer wargame vendors at Origins than there used to be. And that's true. But that's also true of RPG vendors. One of the groups that typically does show up, and they have a big booth, and they have a lot of games from a lot of different publishers, is the Cubicle Studio 2. I'm going to keep doing that. they do vending for Savage Worlds and Mongoose and Palladium and a bunch of other stuff. They weren't there this year either. So,
I was going to come back later in the show to who wasn't there, the notable absences. I didn't want to get to the depressing part of it too early in the show.
Well, I mean, we're still in pandemic here too. I would caution people against drawing sweeping conclusions from the specific vendor's presence or absence this year, right?
I would draw zero conclusions from it for this year.
Right.
I would just throw it all out. Back to the whole, everybody's got stuff stuck on a boat somewhere. Lots of folks have games stuck on a boat. Our boys over at Black Oak Workshop, Craig Zipsy's crew, I'm a big cheerleader for Black Oak. They're some of the nicest people out there. Craig is always one of the coolest people to talk to in the exhibit hall. I swear that the guy doesn't sleep. He just goes home and plugs into the wall to recharge. He's always bouncing off the walls, always one of the peppiest, nicest dudes there. Black Oak Workshop sells dice advent calendars. I got one last year, and as we opened the dice each day, I was posting them to the Dragoons Twitter feed so people could see what's in one of these dice advent calendars. And they were cool. Like, it's a gimmick. Got it. Totally fine. They're still cool, right? It's a fun thing to do if you're a gamer. Great gift if you're a gamer. Those advent calendars are stuck on a boat somewhere. And so if Stellaris, if Academy's Stellaris Kickstarter shows up in February, you open up the game and you play in February. If the advent calendar shows up in February, like, what do? You just sort of stuck. You either convert February into Advent and just a late Advent calendar, or now you're stuck holding on to this thing until next December. And so I was telling everybody, go spend an extra $5 at Black Oak Workshop and help these dudes out, because they're screwed this year if these calendars don't come in off the boat.
Yeah. Well, they got more than $5 out of me.
They got more than five out of me.
my conscience is clear.
So
I buy their dice every year. I really like their dice.
Yeah, the dice are great, and they've got some fun gimmicky ones for folks that enjoy some of the humor with it. One of my favorites is the Disappearing Knight. It's the Black Knight from Monty Python, and so the 6 is the chalice from the end of Monty Python. The 5 is the full knight. The 4, he's missing an arm. The 3, he's missing another arm. The 2, he's missing a leg. And so it's sort of the Disappearing Knight as you go. My favorite one this year that I saw that was the new one was the Rutrow, and
it was good actually.
Scooby-Doo Brown with teal engraving, like Scooby-Doo's collar, and the number 1 says Rutrow on it, which is pretty awesome.
Yes, that is pretty neat.
Yeah, even my wife could appreciate the humor in that one. You know, I told everybody go spend an extra couple bucks at Black Oak, and I'm hopeful that it helped Craig out a bit with some of the other stuff they were selling. Kevin, you had mentioned earlier, what's up with GMT coming to work?
Right. Well, I mean, I'm not trying to, I know that the company went through, some earlier times where they decided to be more conservative about where they go. But, now they're, I'd say they're really, being the dominant force in the war game, in our industry. It would be nice to see them there. And I mean, I'm not trying to throw shade at them at all. I'm just, I think it'd be nice to see them there.
They also have a lot of games with crossover appeal too, like the rail games and the coin games and the Twilight Struggles and the 1960 Making of the Presidents. And, they do a lot that is, I've said in the past that they're the closest thing we have now to Avalon Hill in the sense that, they do war games and maybe they're best known for war games, but they also do a huge range of other non-war game games, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think Dominant Species is one of their best sellers. So,
They keep selling out and they keep reprinting it.
Well, and then they've got, Twilight Struggle.
Right.
If we're talking about non-war games. I just wanted to give Harold a reason to yell at the podcast. That's all. So, Kevin, look, as a part of what we do with our wargaming program, that at the original outset of the wargaming program, one of our requirements, and this has since been relaxed, so this is no longer the case
Thank for God.
Us the way it used to be.
Because this was dumb.
But well, it seems so in hindsight, but at the time it made sense for what John was trying to do. John being John Ward, the head of Gamma, when we started the wargaming program there back in 2014. One of the requirements that we had was that the games that we put on in our areas, some of the official events in the program, were limited to those companies who were there as vendors. And so for the fourth year, we couldn't do GMT, we couldn't do MMP, we couldn't do a bunch of these things because none of those guys were there. Now, very quickly, we worked out the deal with Enterprise Games, where Enterprise was there as GMT rep, and so Enterprise were the sponsor for the GMT events that we did. So we were able to get GMT stuff into the program pretty quickly. But for a long time, unless they were in the building, we couldn't do stuff for them. So, of course, me as one of the primary organizers of this whole thing, I'm calling all these dudes, hey, can you come back to Origins? Because without you there, I can't put your games in the program. And quite frankly, the answer I got from the majority of them was, you know, it'd be kind of cool, but we'd end up losing money. And as a guy who's not running their business, it's hard for me to argue with them when I say, no, please lose money to come support our war game program. That's a tough argument for me to make because I don't want these guys to lose money. I want them to stay in business. I want more war game publishers out there. I want as many as possible being wildly successful for a long time. And one of the challenges, and I've had these specific conversations with, you know, MMP, with GMT, with Compass, with I'm trying to remember all the others that I had talked to over the years, but really part of what it came down to is where a lot of those guys used to get their convention buzz was, hey, we've got a new release, or hey, we've got the designer showing off this new game. Hey, we've got this new thing that you're seeing for the first time at the convention. And that just doesn't happen in the war game space much anymore. These days, when you're dropping,
it doesn't happen in the, honestly, in the convention space anymore. Where it still happens is at Spiel.
Yeah, and that's not war games.
No. I mean, there's no like big convention RPG releases anymore either. There'll be some small ones. I mean, Chaosium had their new RuneQuest starter set for Gen Con, for example. But I mean, it's not like a marquee thing. It's not like a sale thing.
No, but
that's Goodman really complicated.
Always,
you know,
drop a new Dungeon Crawl Classics collection at every Origins.
Oh, but yeah, but that's every month. Yeah, so well, yeah,
but they would have their monster hard, you know, their monster heavy $100 giant hardcovers that they would roll out new at Origins each year.
Yeah.
A problem with those guys is while it would be great to have GMT back in there, who is GMT selling those games to, and what's the pitch they're making for the audience at Origins to be buying them? And I'm not saying we're going to try and figure this out for them like on the podcast here or anything, but that's really the math that they've got to do in their head to figure it out. Is the war game audience there to buy war games from GMT? The flip side of it is, if GMT's not there, why would the war gamers show up? So there's a bit of a chicken and egg going on there. But if GMT is primarily known as one of the big war game companies, but then they show up with Thunder Alley and Dominant Species and Leaping Lemmings and Twilight Struggle, like, who are they actually there to sell those things to? And that's, I think that puts them in a tough spot. Compass Games has a little bit less of that tough spot because they've got fewer of those crossover games. Not zero, but definitely fewer.
Well, more all the time, though.
Both GMT and Compass run their own small conventions that are completely focused on them and bring some more gamers in. I think the economics of Origins, with the relatively high cost to enter and the relatively low percentage of game buying war gamers there, it just hurts.
Well, from a standpoint of, I mean, I think that's indisputable. I think it's only from the standpoint of, you know, vendors, right, of publishers or distributors or whatever, selling their product there. And that's not the only way in which a publisher can engage a convention. Like, you know, maybe there's and I'm just throwing Twilight Struggle out because it's popular. Maybe there's a Twilight Struggle tournament and GMT, whether they're there as a vendor or not, throws in a prize, right? There's other ways to engage that. In the wargaming space, I do feel like the vast majority of publishers have chosen to go down the path of engaging with wargame-specific events rather than with the broader events like your Origins and your Gen Con and maybe even your WBCs, you know?
Probably right. So, Kevin, having dumped all that out there, what are your thoughts on when we're going to see Fort Circle at Origins?
I take a wholly different approach to conventions in that it's not if you make money just by going to the convention, right? We sold X number of games, we make so much profit on that versus it costs us much for the booth. Because you are also exposing your product to a much wider audience, and the person who might buy one, pick up one game, you know, has the potential to be a customer who will buy 5, 6, 8 games as, you know, well, a company like GMT has, you know, well more than that number of games under that they've built. So for me, I think that a convention strategy is pretty important, but, you know, we've only publishing our second game whenever it gets here. I think that it makes sense that we'll probably be there. I would say that we would probably want to do something in the play area where you guys were next year. And then the following year, we would probably have a booth is probably the plan that I would think, because I think we need to have 4 or 5 games to make it sense, make sense to have a booth.
Yeah.
But I assume we'll lose money. I mean, I assume we'll lose money directly if you just compare sales versus cost of, you know, bringing staff and your eating and hotel room and all of that stuff. I know that we'll lose money in a short-term basis, but there is some marketing value of building customer relationships that hopefully last 10 or 15 years until Asmodee buys us for $50 million.
So. Right, and then fires all of you.
Yeah. At that point, who cares? I mean, I'm speaking for GMT, which is not what I mean to do, but just thinking about it rationally, or, you know, from a perspective, is I guarantee you at least half the people at that convention had never heard of GMT, at least half. And they have games that are coming, or more, and they have games coming out that are definitely crossover appeal. You know, we've mentioned some of them, but, you know, Mr. President coming out, I think that there's a lot of Euro gamers that might find some appeal to that. You know, and now that they're doing these, you know, lunch table games, or I'm not sure what they're calling them, the Twilight Struggle Red Sea game, right? It's Twilight Struggle, but you play it in 2 turns. These are games that I think that would engage people at Origins or at Gen Con who might have never heard and never even thought about wargaming. And, you know, Fort Circle is in a interesting spot in that we're not really a war game publisher, we're a historical game publisher. And I would say, you know, looking at our mapped out schedule, a third of our games are on war topics. But, you know, we have a game on the ratification of the 19th Amendment. We have a game on history of the Supreme Court. We have a game on the treason trial of Aaron Burr that, you know, that are being released over the next 18 months. You know, these are games I think that, you know, it makes sense for us to be there, to be selling to that wider audience. But, you know, if we can get some of those folks to then try Shores of Tripoli and then, you know, later try Halls of Montezuma and, you know, start then trying coin games or, you know, games that, you know, maybe not Hex Encounter. Like, I think Hex Encounter is a big step to take us a crossover. Maybe.
Yeah.
But at least, you know, or Academy games, right? Like I think that it makes sense for Academy games to be there for their, you know, birth of a nation. Is that right? That always sounds so awkward. Yeah. No, anyways, it's birth of America.
Birth of a Nation's the really bad film.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why I'm like, I don't think that's what it's called. But so I think that it makes sense for anyone who is trying to reach a broader audience. Now, if you're, you know, doing 500 print runs and you know the 500 people who are going to buy it, then yeah, like, why be there? But I don't think that's what, you know, that's not what Academy Games is. I don't think that's what GMT is either. You know, their print runs are pretty good sized. So,
yeah. And just so we're clear for the audience, we're using GMT as a little bit of shorthand for any of those bigger wargame publishers that aren't at Origins. GMT in particular has a bunch of those crossover titles, like we've mentioned. Look, Apocalypse Road was one of the ones we gave away at our booth as one of the prizes that GMT had graciously donated for us to share with our players. So
I want to be very clear, like, I have a lot of respect for GMT. I own probably more games by them than maybe anyone else, so they're great, but just, yeah, they're kind of a shorthand for players in the space. So
the challenge that we're going to run up against, and I say we as the war game world at large, look, the Armchair Dragoons run the war game program there. If we're asking GMT to show up and sell Dominant Species and Mr. President 1960 and 1989 and Leaping Lemmings and Thunder Alley, but oh, by the way, please sponsor these war game events, man, talk about a schizophrenic space to be in there.
That's them. That's not you, right? You have a focus on the war games and whatever they bring to sell, right? I mean, they, you know, I guess if there's different markets, right? There's what we're calling war gamers, then kind of crossover gamers. Like maybe you're only speaking to one audience, but they're speaking to both, and I don't see why they can't do both at Origins. Yeah.
I'll tell you, one of the other things that had made a difference over the years from the Wargamers, and again, I know this from talking to a bunch of them over the years, is when folks like a GMT or an MMP, the bigger companies back in the day when GDW would show up, we'd get some of those bigger companies. One of the things that made a difference is the designers, the game designers themselves would show up with the publishing company. A lot of times it was the same people, but not, you know, because the designers ran the companies. They were a little more professionally organized these days, but those designers would frequently give talks or seminar speeches at the Origins War College. And so you wouldn't just have, not that this ever happened, but as a, for instance, you wouldn't have GMT show up and then also have Volko or Jason Matthews or somebody like that giving a talk in the Origins War College. You would have some synergy layered in there where now as a fan of these games, it's worth it for me to show up, not just to be able to buy the new thing that is dropping at the convention, but also to have a chance to talk with the designers and to have some engagement there with the company beyond just an exchange of money for product. And that doesn't happen, not just for those guys, but for a lot of publishers anymore. These days, the bulk of the Origins War College are guys from NSDM giving some talks. A couple of people they scrounge up locally, like Matt Caffrey. Larry Bond always gives a talk around the war game stuff that he does. And then under normal conditions, the Dragoons fill in anywhere from 4 to 8 hours worth of Origins War College programming for them as well. What you don't have are the designers. You don't have, I don't know that Chad Jensen ever showed up to give a talk. You know, Gary, help me out here. Who's some of the other designers we need to be throwing out? Dean Essig hasn't been there in forever.
Not a long time. Frank Chadwick hasn't been to Origins in a long time, as far as I know, but he's given War College seminars out at California conventions as recently as 2016.
Yeah. Joe Miranda's been there, but not recently. There was one year when I was moderating the old Games and Sims for Military Training panel, when the panel was James Sterrett, because James was always one of the anchors for that panel, John Tiller, Joe Miranda, Larry Bond, and Matt Caffrey. So you can see why I sort of became the kid brother in the room. Any of us are going to be the kid brother with that panel. But we haven't had that kind of horsepower at the show collectively in the War College for quite a while. And while that doesn't directly impact the wargaming program, it's great synergy when we're able to cooperate like that.
Yeah. Well, are those, I mean, has WBC, like, are the designers going to WBC in any great numbers? And,
yes.
You know, I forget when things are during the summer, because these are usually all summer events, right? So maybe just a strategic choice is being made by where people are allocating their travel dollars and going to WBC.
Well, there's tons of designers that do show up to WBC, but I don't know that there is a seminar track like the War College track.
Right.
So that's one of the other places where the company showing up and treating it more as a marketing PR awareness tool than a sales tool does make a difference. How well can you tie in with the seminar program and be able to bring any of your designers along to be able to give some sort of company update, some sort of, and part of the challenge there is there are so many other channels that those companies now have available to them. Why get on a plane and go to Columbus to do that to a limited audience when I can hit send on an email blast and get everybody at once?
Yeah, but you gotta meet the market where it's at, and different people you reach different, right? You're gonna reach some people by email, and you're gonna reach some people by YouTube, and you're gonna reach some people in, you know, whatever different way. But there's gonna be some people that you reach best by meeting them in person, right? I've met Catastrophe Games, and even though I've backed all their products, now I know I'm going to keep backing them because I met the company and I have an emotional tie to them. And I don't think you can replicate that through most digital means. I think that in-person is just, at least for me, I mean, and I understand some people are different, but for me, that's really hard to replicate.
Yeah. And look, this goes beyond the wargaming world as well, because I first became aware of Black Oak Workshops dice when I backed their original Kickstarter for the Bullseye dice in 2014, 2015, somewhere around there. And then I happened to stumble across them at Origins, talked with Craig briefly. Yeah, I was a backer for the Kickstarter, really loved the dice. And that's when he pulled out, he had some prototypes there of the new D8 Bullseye dice. He's like, here, take a couple of these with you. And he's been such a nice dude to deal with face to face that I was making a point to spend some money with him at Origins every year, because I want to support the nice guys in the business. And so I'm always there for them. And so that kind of emotional tie doesn't happen if I'm just back in a Kickstarter and I never meet the guy in person. So
exactly.
You're absolutely right that does make a difference. I know that when in 2005, 6, 7, when Bayonet Games was a going concern, we did 50 to 60% of our annual sales at Origins or the 1 year we were at Gen Con. So it can definitely be a moneymaker for the small guys. For the big guys, I think it goes back to some of the things you were talking about, that's a good way to go. I want to take a brief left turn here. Gary, this is probably going to be a little more you and me because Kevin hadn't been to Origins before this year. A quick run through of who wasn't there. This is not a how dare you not show up. The reality is we're in a plague, right? There's a pandemic out there. People are not showing up for whatever reason. They don't want to deal with the travel. Their sales are hurting because of the pandemic. They just didn't feel like Origins was worth the money this year. Quite frankly, for a bunch of them, being in October screwed things up because it's not in the summer when it's easier to grab your people and travel. Just off the top of my head, a handful of the ones that weren't there. You mentioned Studio 2.
Studio 2
is usually sharing a booth or adjacent to Carolina Game Tables. So BoardGameTables.com was there adjacent to Wormwood. Mm-hmm. The Carolina Game Tables with Jody and Clint from down here in North Carolina, they were not there. Goodman Games was not there. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of different war game publishers that have kind of come and gone over the years, but folks like Lock and Load weren't there. CMON was not there, although I'm not 100% sure what CMON's status is anymore with Origins coming or going. Catalyst Game Labs had the big play space up at the front of the area where they had a bunch of organized play going on for Battletech and Shadowrun, but Catalyst did not have a sales booth at all.
No.
We didn't have Paizo, didn't have WizKids, didn't have Wizards, don't normally have any or all of those three in full force. But none of those guys were around.
Yeah.
So, those are just ones off the top of my head. What are some other notables that you can think of that might have been there in years past and weren't this time?
I mean, Wizards of the Coast hasn't been there in years, right? So I don't think that's important or noteworthy. Paizo often does not have, in my recollection anyway, does not have a sales area, but they usually have a huge, you know, room and all the people from Paizo are there to run the Pathfinder stuff. And I think there was still a decent amount of Pathfinder, but I didn't see any of it because I didn't go over there.
But I think the Pathfinder stuff was all a little more ad hoc this year. It was not organized and run by the Paizo folks the way it normally is, I don't think.
I don't know. That sounds plausible.
Okay.
There is a Columbus local Pathfinder Society program that could have, you know, fielded enough GMs to run the, you know, a decent sized Pathfinder track by itself. So,
yeah. Looney Labs wasn't there.
Yeah, they're usually there. Steve Jackson Games was there. I mean, they had a decent sized booth. Atlas Games was there. Both of those are companies I've bought a lot of stuff from in the past, but whose current corporate plan forward does not seem to include stuff I'm interested in. So, didn't really do much with either of them.
Something that struck me as a little odd was usually for the last several years, Steve Jackson Atlas Games have kind of been in one space together. Steve Steve had their own big separate play area out front, which was kind of cool because I hadn't seen that in a while. Normally that's Mayfair, Rio Grande kind of folks. But
they had that in 2019 too, though.
Yes, but they hadn't for a long time up until then. And then they had the you know, one of the larger right up front booths in the exhibit hall, which was kind of cool. So
yeah. So just for, I'm not sure if this any of this applies to 2018 or not. Excuse me. Atlas and Steve Jackson Games were sharing booth space for years, and I know that that was not the case in 2019. I'm not 100% sure about 2018. Atlas had the only sales booth in the play area. That
yes,
I think that might not be true, but the other one would have been Magic the Gathering, which, you know, is well into the territory of who cares for me. So, but like in 2019, there was about half a dozen of those companies, and this year it was only Atlas Games, and that was probably a space thing, I suspect. Hard to say. I mean, there's Wizards of the Coast hasn't been there for years. GMT hasn't been there for years. The big pullouts, the big pullout was probably Paizo, I think.
Yeah, could
well. And again, you know, who knows what their calculus looks like right now? There's all kinds of variables that, you know, do we feel safe from a health management standpoint, sending our people to this convention to be pawed by people with questionable hygiene for 4 days? To do we have the, can we spare the time for the people that need to be there? Because it's October, it's not June or July, right? So,
yeah.
I mean, that's a factor. People have, you know, academic calendars and political calendars and all other kinds of considerations. And you know, all other things being equal. Well, let's assume that people take more time off in the summertime.
So I know that summer versus October ended up wiping out a good half dozen of our usual GM crew.
Oh, at least.
More so than the pandemic. That's what really, you know, knocked us off. Just pulling up to take a look because I was curious. I've got a partial version of the 2019 exhibit hall map sitting in front of me right now. I don't recall if Arcane Wonders was there this time or not. Stronghold Games was in a much smaller space. Both Studio 2 and Cubicle 7, the two companies you keep trying to combine, were not there this year.
But I haven't even tried to combine them with DreamPod 9 yet.
So DreamPod 9, well, but Gale Force 9 has been there in years past and was not this time. Aiello was there in a limited capacity. Normally they've got a much bigger space, but part of that might have just been because the entire exhibit hall was smaller.
Yeah, they still had a big booth. I mean,
yes,
especially as big as normal. No, I guess not, but it was still one of the bigger booths in the room.
Yeah, Kenzer and Company was not there at all. Mentioned,
no, you're right. Kenzer was there in 2019. You're absolutely right about that.
Yeah, we already mentioned Goodman Games. WizKids had a big booth in 2019 and were not there this time. Some smaller companies that aren't as, you know, meaningful to the Wargamers: Gray Fox Games, Norse Foundry, Renegade Games, Plan B Games. There were some others that weren't there. Asmodee North America had a big space last time that they weren't there at all this time, but that's because they're busy selling to, you know, some other space millionaire or something. I'm not sure who they're selling to these days anymore. Griglin Games wasn't there this time around. We were missing some of the smaller wargame companies that normally are there. Normally Mark Walker's companies are there in some capacity with Flying Pig and Tiny Battle in their booth together. Mark owns them both, right? So it makes sense they would be there together. They weren't there this year. And again, I don't know if that was October or state of the company or pandemic or why. Hadn't talked to him, so don't know. But the fact is he wasn't there when normally they would be. So
who was there, and I don't think we've mentioned him, was PSC, the Plastic Soldier Company. They were there.
They were.
Which, despite their name, doesn't have any games with miniatures that I've seen. Maybe they do, but
I believe they were the ones that had March on the Drina for sale at their booth.
Maybe. I was more drawn to Blitzkrieg, to Paolo Mori's Blitzkrieg, which they were selling the new edition of. And there's a follow-up game called Caesar, Conquer Rome in 20 Minutes. That is another design of Paolo's that I was more interested in those than I was in March on the Drina.
If that's the booth where Blitzkrieg was, different booth, not the okay. same.
I do remember seeing March on the Drina, though.
Yeah. Again, this is one of those things, you know, and Kevin, I'm not sure how much you unearthed in your walks through the exhibit hall. Lots of people are complaining about, damn it, there's no wargaming at Origins. Well, there's the Catastrophe booth and the Decision booth and the Academy booth. But then you do run into, hey, March on the Drina is for sale in this other booth that's selling like 15 things you don't care about. But there's also a wargame for sale in there. And Blitzkrieg is for sale in a booth with like 12 other things you don't care about. But then there's Blitzkrieg there. You know, the one in the very back corner that had a whole bunch of different Asmodee products for sale, they were a retailer, not a publisher, but they were the same folks that had all the bolt action stuff for sale back there.
A letter arrived for them. They are all fired.
Okay.
You know, I haven't been to Origins in the past, so I can't compare to who was there. But, you know, I was a member of Gamma in 1999 and have been for most of this time, even though I wasn't involved in the industry. And I think Gamma is going through a little bit of an existential crisis about who they represent and what they want to be. And I think that, you know, that's going to affect who's coming to their convention, especially because their convention isn't really professionally run, right? It's run in-house. And so, you know, with Gamma changing its board structure.
I could not have put that better myself.
Delicately,
he'd appeared a little more plainly.
So you're being
very diplomatic about this, Kevin.
Yes. So I find it shocking that, you know, Hasbro's Wizards and the new Avalon Hill, which they've moved stuff to. Like, maybe this year is the exception because of the pandemic, but like it's shocking to me that they're not there. Because they used to always be at the Gamma Trade Show, or at least up until 2015 or so, with the last time I was there. And I think these war game companies were talking about whether they're there or not. Are they Gamma members? And why, you know, unless this show is really run in an amazing way, or it's really drawing the right audience, you know, Gamma's sort of got to figure out who they are and who they're trying to attract to this convention. Because it's their main moneymaker, so they need to figure that out, I guess. And that sounded a little meaner towards Gamma than I meant for it to sound. But
you can mean for it to sound however you want. I will tell you, so the existential crisis piece of it is not unnoticed by people, even just, you know, fans of the industry, not even necessarily being in the industry. I promise that's noticed by other folks as well.
So. I think it was 2018. Maybe it was 2017, but 2018 they had a huge Avalon Hill display with a friggin' tank. It was neat. I mean, granted that their marquee product that year was Axis and Allies and Zombies, but it was still they had a big sign that said Avalon Hill with a tank in front of it, and that was awesome.
Yeah, as our boy Cyrano pointed out, Axis and Allies and Zombies was the answer to the question that no one was asking.
It was their attempt to cash in on a trendy topic, I guess. And I'm, you know, that's what it is. People like zombies for a while. It's old now. Thanks. Have a nice day.
On the war game side, some folks that have been with us in years past but weren't there this year. We didn't have Lost Battalion. We didn't have Lock and Load. We didn't have Collins Epic. We didn't have Proving Ground. Those folks have all worked with us to varying degrees over the years. In some cases, in the case of Proving Ground, I think they're defunct. I think they've called it a day and unplugged the company. In the case of Lost Battalion, I know there was a falling out with Gamma, and I'm not expecting to see them again. In the case of Lock and Load, for Dave, it's just an economics issue that, you know, going back to some of the stuff we talked about before, it's a lot of work for Dave to pack that thing up and move it, and October doesn't make it any easier.
Yeah, and my understanding is they make a lot more money at WBC.
Yeah. And again, go make money. Like, I am not ever going to stand in the way of a company going out and making their money.
I can't make this kind of decision for somebody else in business, right? So, I mean, if GMT or Lock and Load or whoever says, hey, we're going to lose more money on this, we don't think it's worth it, I don't have access to the things that they're looking at, the metrics that they have available. So I can't make the decision for them. But I agree with Kevin in that there's a lot more value in a presence for one of these publishers at one of these big conventions than is necessarily easy to quantify on a balance sheet at the end of on Monday morning. There's a lot of exposure. There's a lot of ability to promote that doesn't necessarily automatically turn into that, you know, same day sales on the convention floor, that can potentially, if done right, done well, can potentially bring a lot of value to your convention experience.
Yeah. You're right that there's not always a straight line between appear at convention to line 27 on the balance sheet. I think that is definitely a true state. So I could totally see that. We've been going 90 minutes as we're recording this. Once I edit out me saying, we'll lose like 10 minutes of time there, and that's fine. But looking forward to Origins 2022 at this point, because we are less than a year away. We are hopeful that the Dragoons are back closer to full force. If as long as June happens the way June is supposed to happen, we should have closer to our fuller crowd there. Now, with that said, both of you gentlemen have threatened to show up and do stuff with us. Kevin, you talked about bringing some game stuff out as a part of the Wargame HQ, show off some of Fort Circle stuff. What was it you had in mind, understanding that I'm not asking you to sign a contract to commit to stuff now? I'll just harangue you about it in May when we're scrambling to get the events together.
Sure. Well, you know, I, as a good guest, I defer to what my host would like me to do. But, you know, despite Fort Circle not exactly being a war game company, you know, I do have, you know, a little experience playing war games. So, you know, I'd bring what you want. Obviously, if anybody wanted to play Shores of Tripoli, I'd be happy to do that. But, you know, I can play some real games, too, if that would be helpful. So I like, and to be honest, I spent a lot of my life as a hobby running college debate tournaments. And so I really like hosting events and running things. And so, you know, however you can use me, I'm happy to help out.
Well, I'm sure we'll find a way to make good on that threat there. So Gary, you had talked about something big.
Yes. Something very, very big that hasn't been seen at Origins for many years. Maybe. We'll see. But we're having some discussions about bringing some Hex and a large format Hex Encounter game to the Armchair Dragoons area next year.
Mm.
Yeah.
So that and people can, you know, sit down and play all weekend if they want, but can also, that also will accommodate people hopping in and out. And maybe another couple of adjacent tables with smaller footprint, you know, can be played in 4 hours or less type games. Hex Encounter stuff alongside those things. And you know, we'd probably take Hex Encounter to be fairly broad meaning in this particular case. We'd probably say yes to say Washington's War or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Area Encounter will apply.
Yeah, so, you know, but you know, games that are, you know, That nobody's really arguing whether they're war games or not. Let me put it that way.
Oh, somebody will argue.
Oh, yeah, but we will. I will throw them out.
Sure. So one of the things that we had talked about with that and understanding we're not committing to a specific game.
Oh, no, not yet.
Game system or anything yet. But one of the things we talked about with this larger format game is to leave the entire game up and running all weekend, but break some of the play up into some of those 4 hour blocks that we can enter into the event grid. So on Wednesday evening, we might have our first session of whatever game it is, you know, Colossal Hex Encounter game one, whatever it might be. And so we'll have folks that will show up to play in that Wednesday night 4 hour event. We're going to leave that sucker set up because first of all, it's going to take forever to set up, but Thursday at noon, when number two shows up, when we get around to event number two, they're going to pick up where Wednesday night left off. And so we're going to leave everything in place and keep the same campaign going, even though we tag some players in and out. I think that's kind of the general idea we'd have, right?
Yep, it absolutely is.
Yeah. So if you're really hardcore about this and you want to stick with that game all weekend long, sure, you can register for 4 or 5, however many sessions Gary's crazy enough to run.
It's not going to just be me. I'm going to be leveraging local talent for this.
Sure. So we'll have that group and however many sessions they're going to want to do over the course of the weekend, like you could register for all of them. That's great. Like you'll be the one at that point. We got a question why you're not just volunteering to work with us, but you could do it if you just wanted to show up and play the whole time. That's cool. Or if you just wanted to try it for 4 hours to get a taste to sort of scratch that itch for the big game and then go off and do other things with the rest of your life. Like, that's cool, too. Just register for one session, pop in, play with us for 4 hours, and then move on and do something else.
We're also going to be looking at something that can be played to a reasonable conclusion in 3 days of play. So we're figuring, you know, assuming Origins is the traditional Wednesday through Sunday time frame, which is what the schedule says right now, that, right, you know, it'll be like a Thursday, Friday, Saturday that we could play, you know, pretty much all day in those three games and then reach a reasonable conclusion in that time. So we're not going to be playing, you know, Fire in the East is the obvious example. They never made all that much progress on that just because of the number of counters that had to be pushed around.
Yeah, World in Flames.
Yeah, no, World in Flames plays faster than you might think.
No, but it doesn't set up any faster than that. We'd have to start setting up on Monday.
Well, I don't know about that, but it certainly is not a fast setup game. You could play, you could get through a good chunk of a full game of WIF in a 4 day convention.
Yeah. At some point in here, we get to throw in the mandatory Case Blue punchline, right?
We can. I mean, I could bring it. We could pretend to set it up.
Not that we're going to. Gary's still clipping the counters and he started in 2016.
I started in 2019, actually, but or 2020. Was it 2020? I guess it was 20. I think it was. I don't forget. But I have been clipping that thing for a long time. It's still not fully organized.
Yeah. So, Kevin, you see what you're getting yourself into here.
It sounds like a party.
Yeah. We are planning on having a good time. Keep in mind, too. So for folks that are longtime players with us, a lot of this stuff they know. But for folks that aren't normally gaming with us at Origins, a couple of things to know about the Wargaming HQ as the Dragoons run it there. We have a handful of these big events. Everything we do is blocked into either 2 hours or 4 hours. And part of that is based around the cost of the generic tokens and what you get. And so rather than only give somebody 1 hour's worth of stuff when 1 hour versus 2 hour costs the same, we're going to maximize your value by filling the space to the maximum dollar figure you're paying. We've got a handful of things that we block off as those 4 hour events that are kind of the big rocks that go in the jar first. And something like the bigger extended campaign game, like Gary was talking about, is definitely going to be one of those. That's usually where you find our CPXs, where you find those command post games, where a bunch of our team sort of coach a group of players together as a military staff through a shared operation. Our guys play the bad guys in that game. And so you're fighting against some of our dudes. But you're doing it in real time as you're having to adjust the plan while the battle is unfolding. And so that's kind of cool. Gary's done that a couple of times and had fun with it.
Let me make sure I state that the thing that I would like to organize is not intended to displace any of the typical banner tentpole events that the Dragoons do.
Oh, no. I don't think... If we left anybody with that impression, we certainly did not mean to.
I don't think we did, but I just wanted to say that just in case.
Yeah. We also, assuming we've got Cyrano and the gang back with us, we fully intend to have at least 2 4-hour double-blind Kriegspiel events where we're going to have the study carols up, everybody staring at their one map while they look like they're taking the LSATs from afar. And we're going to have the runners running around the booth. We're going to have a couple of tables set aside for just that. At the times at which those run, those were really popular. People had a great time with them. Our team had a great time running them. We definitely want those back on the schedule. We'll have to see whether or not I'm up to doing another team coin event after like the fourth year in a row. They're starting to wear on me a little. I may need to draft an assistant GM to help keep those moving along. But they're fun. The players really enjoy them. So it's, you know, if I can find somebody to keep that torch burning to help out with that, then we'll probably have some of those back on. For the smaller games, we're going to get as many of the two-hour games in there as we realistically can. Gary had Commands and Colors this time around. I had some Tank on Tank from Lock and Load this time around. We had Second World War at Sea. What else? We had Age of Dogfights this time around. Mm-hmm. In the past, we've had Lock and Load Tactical. We've had Fort Sumter. We've had, I'm trying to think of some of the other smaller things that we've had over the years. We've had some stuff from Columbia over the years. With our program, we do raffle tickets for everybody that plays in our games. And when we have enough of them, we'll have a prize for every single event. So somebody's leaving each event with something for, you know, from that table. And then whatever's left over, we raffle off on Sunday morning and we give away. And so the pictures that you've seen online on our Twitter feed and in our news articles of the guys that won prizes from the raffle, those were things that Wargame companies had donated to us in appreciation of and support for the Wargaming community that comes out to be playing games with us. And that's really cool. We had a couple of big prizes this year. So you're not just playing games, you're playing games with a good chance of winning some stuff, meeting some new friends, trying out some new things. If we got Kevin there, we're going to have designers showing off their own games. So, you know. All that said, closing question here. Kevin, what are you most looking forward to for next Org?
Well, I'm looking forward to not wearing a mask and being not worried about everyone else. I think that's sort of probably a universal hope that everyone has. But no, I mean, I thought this was great despite it being, you know, only at half or quarter speed. And so, you know, I'm looking forward to just meeting that many more people. And you know, it was also a compressed schedule. So, and in fact, Jason and I left on Saturday because I needed to get home for something on Sunday. So, and I'm looking forward to a full schedule. I think it's going to be great next year.
I hope so. Gary, it's probably your big running campaign game, but beyond that, what are you most looking forward to for Origins next year?
Well, I was going to say, but, you know, return of Monster Gaming to Origins. I can't lie and say I won't be looking forward to walking around without a mask, because I do not enjoy walking around wearing a mask.
Yeah.
Also, you know, the return of, I'd like to, I mean, I'll be playing in that big monster game too, pretty much. So that will keep me out of the dealer's room spending money.
No, it won't. We know better.
Well, it won't completely, but it'll help a little bit.
I will make sure to schedule you between 10 and 6 every day.
That's fine.
I will tell you that the walking around without a mask on is definitely going to be helpful. More than that, I'm looking forward to not GMing with a mask on. That was a real son of a bitch.
Yeah.
talk about a voice killer. I'm looking forward to the unexpected, something like Song for War. Like, we had no idea. Look, Gary, you and us are significant members of the wargaming media. We'd never heard of this and had no clue what it was. It totally snuck up on us.
Nope, but stay tuned to the channel.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to the unexpected, the not unexplained, but the off the wall, the, oh, wow, we never saw this coming sort of thing that you discover at Origins that becomes some really new, cool, fancy, this is awesome kind of thing that you stumble across. A couple of years ago, our boy Cyrano picked up SEAL Team Flicks. It was a little flick game of, you know, zipping pucks around different maps for SEAL Team raids and missions. And man, that thing got played a bunch after hours at our booth area. Nobody had a clue that was there. We just sort of stumbled across it. It looked like fun, and it's probably even more fun when you're imbibing. But that's the kind of off-the-wall, oddball sort of thing that I look forward to discovering at Origins each year, but, you know, especially next year. So that'll be kind of cool. Gents, thank you very much for giving up some of your weeknight, especially Gary. This is now show number 2 tonight for you. So that's very kind of you to do that. And Kevin, thank you for joining us for the first time here on Mentioning Dispatches. We'll bring you back sometime when you can pimp your company a little more directly.
Oh, always happy to do that.
Didn't think we'd have to twist your arm for that one. So, audience, thank you for joining us for this episode of Mentioning Dispatches. The Compass catalog is starting to show up in people's mailboxes. So I imagine the Compass catalog podcast episode is probably not too far in the future around all the other ones we've already committed to this season. So thank you for joining us. Thank you to the guests, and thank you to Gamma for actually pulling off Origins this year. That was really cool. We were glad to do it, glad to talk about it, and it felt great being back in an actual real game convention. So look forward to the rest of the season, and we'll see everybody next summer slinging dice at Origins.